episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by two special guests, our data protection consultant Charlotte Hogg and support desk manager Tristan Mills. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
So thank you for stepping in this week because Joe and Phil decided to abandon us all and take some time off. How dare they? But it was a great session, GDPR radio, where we covered quite a lot in the news, to be fair, and it's things that, you know, they come up time and time again around Meta and Apple and you know, WhatsApp and ChatGPT, but it's all new stuff, all progression in the same field. How did you think it went?
Yeah,
it was a really good interactive session, and it was nice to see some of our listeners actually join in today as well and get that conversation rolling a bit more.
Yeah, definitely. Especially it was nice to see Dave Coates as well returning. So we'll get him on a session for housing. as he's put himself forward, he's volunteered as tribute. So but yeah, how did you find it, Tristan?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's been a bit of a kind of a crazy week, and there's still a lot to kind of follow from the recent adequacy decision to the US. So there's still like a lot of kind of talk and debate around that. And as you said about AI, Meta, privacy notices, encryption with Apple and whatnot. So it's been quite a nice session just to kind of get up to date with the latest news.
Yeah, exactly. And two big bills in question as well. So the data protection bill, which is probably likely to be tabled again, but it's back on the books. And then the social housing reform bill as well, which has been passed through Royal Assent. So
looks like another podcast will be coming up on that bill then. Watch this space.
I hear that as a little volunteer from yourself as well.
It's gonna have to be me, isn't it?
Absolutely. But yeah, there was quite a lot to cover off in the news. Usually we'll talk about interesting cases that we've been on in the week as well. There's only really one that we had time for today around what is considered personal and domestic use, and when does an individual become caught by the GDPR. So yeah, enjoy the session. We cover a lot off in it, and like I said last week, if you've got any recommendations on what you'd like to us to talk about on a podcast, email us at info@dataprotectionpeople.com and we'll see what we can do. But in the meantime, enjoy the session. So what have you both been up with this week, or both been on with this week anyway?
I've been writing a lot of reports this week, to be honest. So report writing, that's about it.
I've been going over third-party supplier questionnaires, QA, meetings with clients. Been a busy week.
It has been a busy week, a very busy week. Seems just constantly on the up, which I guess is a good thing. I've been working in a new realm this week, actually, with Dave. I've been working with channel partners, so trying to drive revenue through that from the sales side. Working on PCI DSS and a lot of SARS as well. SARS seems to be on the rise again. The SAR team have been quite busy this week, so it's been full on, but a good one, to be fair.
Nice.
So yeah, I mean, and as well, there's been a lot of news up and around this week, so I think we've got a lot to cover today. I don't know about you two, but I've seen a few pieces. So there's a new regulation on the harmonisation of rules regarding GDPR enforcement. So the European Commission has proposed a new regulation for additional procedural rules. Sorry, my screen's gone a bit weird there. Relating to the enforcement of the GDPR, so the new regulation aims to make the handling of cross-border data protection cases more efficient by harmonising administrative procedures and elaborating existing rules on cooperation between EU supervisory authorities. So it proposes to standardise the information that data subjects must provide to lodge a complaint regarding cross-border processing, and the rules for acceptance or rejection of the complaint. And it also introduces the possibility of resolving complaints through an amicable settlement and harmonises the rights of the parties, controls or processes under investigation. So that's hopefully a positive move that you might make.
Yeah, that sounds really positive. Interesting. Anything to do with changes to the UK GDPR, I always get a little bit unsettled because I'm thinking, oh gosh, adequacy decisions. But actually, this sounds like it's going to be working more with the other kind of the other regulators in Europe. So I welcome that change. That sounds really positive.
Yeah. I've also seen as well the UK gets new status in Global Data Privacy Certification Programme. So the UK has become the first country in the world to be granted associate status in the Global Cross-Border Privacy Rules Forum. So this forum works to support international data transfers between member countries and safeguard standards on data protection and privacy. The UK's associate status means that it'll be able to drive cooperation on international data flows with member nations, including the US, Canada, Mexico, Japan, the Republic of Korea, the Philippines, Singapore, and Chinese Taipei.
I mean, again, it just kind of strengthens, you know, hopefully that our position for, you know, to remain adequate. You know, I believe that I believe that's next year when the European Commission is going to revisit our adequacy decision. So, you know, again, this is quite positive stuff and just strengthens our kind of posture for that adequacy decision. Well, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, you hope so. What have you seen anyway? Anything of interest?
Yeah, well, yesterday was IAPP did a podcast talking about the new the US privacy framework, and you know, I was kind of like listening in, taking a few notes down, and you know, they highlighted a really interesting point about, you know, the possibility of a Schrems 3, and from listening to it, I got the impression that a new case would be less likely. This privacy framework does seem to be a lot more robust, and hopefully we won't be getting any scary Court of Justice for the European Union saying that it's going to be inadequate, causing a lot of panic for a lot of people.
So in the podcast, did they talk about Pfizer and how, you know, that's been rectified? Because I still don't fully understand how they've reached this decision when, you know, the regulations in Pfizer still grant law enforcement access to any information, even though that's due for renewal at the end of this year.
That's a good point. I only kind of caught the first half of the podcast for, you know, other things kind of came up, but I do think when looking about that, I think a part of the privacy framework is that they have brought in like a regulatory body to kind of oversee everything. So that's a possibility of how they've maybe got around it. It'll be something that I think is worth definitely having to look into and possibly bringing up for our next podcast about the Pfizer interaction with this new privacy framework coming in. Another thing actually that was really interesting that I did catch from this podcast is that legally there's the possibility that, if need be, states could be granted adequacy decision, individual states. Now, in practical sense, I think that'd be a lot more of a headache, but
how would that work?
Well, with the US still not having a federal, there's always talk about them adopting a federal privacy kind of framework and a privacy standard, but they still haven't kind of got something in place. Whereas a lot more states are implementing their own kind of privacy regulations. So the big one is California. They have this as a California Consumer Protections Act, which I believe is now changed to the Privacy Rights Act. We have other states, I believe, like Colorado and Utah, that are also implementing their own privacy standards. I do agree. It'd be interesting how that would work on paper, with the federal law effectively being possibly to overwrite state law. But it is just an interesting mechanism that is actually built into the GDPR.
I wonder, you know, as well, going back to your previous point on Pfizer. Sorry, I had a thought in my head.
That's all right.
You're doing a fill.
Just jumping through.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering on that, whether a way to, I guess, tackle that in the meantime is to just be transparent. So in terms of, you know, US law enforcement accessing any information, if they obviously they granted that right by just under the legislation, but if they were to inform companies or individuals of this, you know, of any access and requests, maybe that's a way around it under the framework and the notice principle and whatnot. But I guess we'll see how that one progresses. So why do they think that Schrems 3 might not be the case?
So their positioning is that the justification of this framework and having like another body in place basically makes it a lot more difficult for them not to be able to prove it. So when you look at Schrems 1 was about saying, well, what is the necessity, what is the proportionality, and no company or organization or like outside of the EU could kind of demonstrate that. Schrems 2 then kind of basically set the rules and standards of what is necessity and proportionality, and effectively saying, well, the US, that is not there, you know, under federal law, you know, police officers and any kind of government official can request personal data without a warrant, which is kind of the big problem that kind of goes against GDPR, that kind of like lawful basis and that being able to demonstrate compliance. And so with this new kind of body, I believe it's that they can start to kind of demonstrate the necessity and the proportionality that is required under the UK, well, not the UK GDPR, but the EU GDPR. And yeah.
Okay.
Another kind of interesting point to kind of jump off that is that we still did a quick look from the ICO, still no blog or media about it. I've not checked LinkedIn. They might have said something on LinkedIn, but when I had a look at their website this morning, still nothing.
Yeah. I wonder if that, you know, comes into play with, well, the data reform bill that's underway again, isn't it? So
yeah, the latest monsoon session started yesterday. So the data reform bill and I think 30 other bills have been put forward yesterday. But it is interesting to note that people are under the impression that it's going to get tabled again quite quickly, which I probably wouldn't be surprised by, because everything else seems to be taking precedent over it. And I can see a general election coming first. So we'll see what happens with that one. But speaking of that monsoon session, 7 bills were passed through Royal Assent yesterday. And one of them was the social housing reform bill. But there's no news on it. But I had a look on the website this morning and it's been passed through Royal Assent now. So it'd be interesting to see what some of those pieces in there are actually going to look like. See, Dave's got his hand up.
Hello there. Good afternoon,
hello.
Everybody.
Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi, yeah. As it happens, I've just been on a seminar with the Department of Communities and Levelling Up about the social housing bill and the ramifications, obviously, around possible data protection, because there's the new access to information scheme, or the ATIS, as it's going to be called. Similar to FOI, but not the same, if you know what I mean. So DCLUG, or whatever they call themselves, are now consulting widely on how ATIS is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the social bill got Royal Assent yesterday, so it's now the Act. But the ATIS elements is going to take a little while to kick in.
Well, I can imagine.
There's a lot of consultation going on. My couple of takeaways from that were the way ATIS works and the way FOI works is that you can apply exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
Those exemptions are quite complicated. And I think if we just put that in the arena of the DPO within an organisation, for example, try and apply those exemptions, and I think those decision-making around the exemptions go beyond the DPOs. And you've got to get the organisation involved in these exemptions, and you've got to be really careful. And secondly, the way ATIS is going to work is that you'll be able to disclose information about contractors, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll probably need to, in a similar way with contracts and the clauses, we've got bits in there about subject access requests and data breaches. We'll probably have to put in something about ATIS as well.
Oh, yeah.
About the contractors having to give us certain information, etc.
Yeah.
So yes, it is in the Act now, but it will take a little way to roll out the ATIS.
Yeah, and I think the other big thing to take from that bill as well is, you know, when it comes to the Housing Ombudsman and the regulator having more sort of, they can just jump in and say, we need this, you have 24 hours, give it to us, thank you. So I think it's really important that housing associations really start to get their sort of ducks lined up nicely, because otherwise, when it does come into effect fully, I think it might be a little bit of a mad dash.
So I've been given the lovely job of forming an action plan.
Oh, of course you have.
Yes, so yes, indeed. But as that unfolds, I'm happy to share.
That would be great. I had a meeting with one of my clients who's a social housing provider earlier in the week, and they were saying that their complaints department has decided to split themselves in two. So they have all of like the client customer facing complaints, and they've now got a new team that are going to be solely responsible for everything that comes through from both the regulator and from the ombudsman. So when these 24-hour requests come through, it goes directly to that team, and they're the only ones that will be working on that. So I thought that was probably quite a good approach, but it depends if you've got the resource internally to be able to do something like that.
There is a lot of things to, maybe in the future we can have a separate session on that as we
we've not done a housing reform bill session in a hot minute, so maybe it's worth thinking about that.
I wouldn't mind taking an active part in it. What about that? Can't turn down an offer like that, can you?
No, you can't.
Whether we'll be in
it. No, I'm sure you will. I had a call with a customer earlier in the week as well about you know, the housing ombudsman spot checks on housing associations, framework and documentation. So they've had a look at it. They've not been requested for information by the housing ombudsman yet, but it is obviously random, so they're preparing for that. But in doing so, they've kind of realized that all of their documentation is completely outdated, and it's the whole project. So they're now coming to us because they've not really got the internal resource for it, for getting all of the data protection documentation in place, as well as, you know, everything else that's being requested. But that would be outside of our remit, I'd say. I think there's a bit of panic more than anything around.
I think
it,
so.
But yeah, we'll see how it progresses anyway. It's finally underway. I think for a long time we've been consistently asked, what can we do to prepare for it? And there's not really been a lot we can do because it's, you know, nothing's confirmed. You don't want to waste resource and time and so on in preparing for something that might not actually, you know, fall part of the final decision. But there'll be a lot underway now, I'm sure, with our customer base as well being such housing focus, that it's going to be.
I know a couple of our clients were asked to be part of the pilot for some of it as well. So it'd be interesting to hear back from them and see how they thought it went as well, I reckon.
Definitely. So a lot underway. What else have you seen in the news? And thank you, Dave. We'll definitely be in touch about that session. Have you seen anything else in the news?
It's been a fair bit around this week, to be honest.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about probably the big one? I guess WhatsApp changing their legal basis for processing recently.
Your one then.
Go. So on Monday, so 17th of July, WhatsApp updated their privacy policy, switching to legitimate interest for legal basis following the Irish Data Protection Commissioner's sanction in January. The general data protection regulation and the EU privacy framework requires organizations that process personal data to have a legal basis on which to do so. So in January, Ireland's Data Protection Authority decided that WhatsApp's legal basis was not sufficiently founded and mandated that the instant messaging app find a new one, which was originally, I believe, was Contract. Back in 2018, when Meta took over several other organizations, they actually, I think, had a clause in their privacy notice by signing up to our privacy policy. You know, you agree to like these kind of changes, effectively following Contract. And effectively, the Irish board kind of come out and said, well, no, that isn't correct. It needs to be something else. Mm. And as a result, it's been legitimate interest. What do you guys think?
I think it's interesting. And to be honest, it did need to change. So I can understand why legitimate interest has probably been chosen, because let's face it, they can't rely on consent easily. I don't know how they would be able to pick public interest or vital interest either. So
So this is relating to advertising, to marketing.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, because I had to read around it and I couldn't find specifically what processing activities it related to. But obviously, Facebook, we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, but Facebook, came under fire from the European Court of Justice for relying on contract for targeted advertising. So I believe that Meta's changed the lawful basis across all platforms. I don't know if this is just going over my head or not, but I don't understand how legitimate interests is an appropriate basis. Well, I understand why they'd want to rely on it, but I don't know how they can.
I did find, I think moments before this podcast, I believe the Court for Justice has kind of said that it might challenge legitimate interest as that decision, as it might, they don't think it might not be appropriate, because if you are using direct marketing, you have to rely on consent, and, it's legitimate interest as a soft opt-in appropriate.
If it was a service message or like a critical message for users, then I can see legitimate interest being the most appropriate one, but in my mind, consent is the more viable option. But
under the Privacy and Electronic Communications Regulations, you need consent for electronic direct marketing, unsolicited direct marketing. I don't know how you'd be able to rely on soft opt-in, even though that relates more to consent, I'd say. Despite it being, targeted advertising or behavioural advertising, that doesn't mean that, an individual's purchased something previously that relates to that advertising just because they've got a Facebook account. I'm going into Facebook here, not necessarily WhatsApp, but you see, this is another thing that doesn't make sense as well. So I don't think I've ever received advertising on WhatsApp. It's a messaging platform. So I don't understand what the privacy, what the process and activities are that it relates to.
So one of the things that I've started to notice that is on WhatsApp, disclose, I use WhatsApp, that they've started to implement stories and whatnot, and they seem to be following a similar thing to kind of like Meta's other products. Like with Facebook, you've got the story. I've noticed it a little bit. But it seems to be following the same suit as like Instagram and Facebook. You know how they have like their stories and advertisements in there. So it could be the case that they're gearing up to prepare for that. But I've always assumed that WhatsApp as a platform was designed to be private messaging, in a way to ensure that whatever message you send is encrypted and is protected. Definitely an interesting one.
With WhatsApp, there's just issues from every angle, isn't there? There's issues around privacy concerns for individuals, and then obviously using it in a business setting as well, and that comes up even still to this day, organizations wanting to use it. And it's just, obviously we'd advise to avoid it where possible, but some organizations just don't see it as possible. And how do you manage that?
We had a case that came in a little while ago. I wasn't going to mention it because I don't think it was relevant, but some that is relevant here, where, what are the liabilities that it was to do with us, from a corporate perspective, we have people using WhatsApp in a work environment. Does that fall in the scope of a SAR if they talk about an individual and whatnot? And it is quite a scary one and a dangerous one, because you start to blend that, you know, corporate device and corporate rules with personal devices and personal rules, and you do have not just a GDPR, you also have other areas of kind of compliance with, like, you know, employment law and whatnot. So it is a really kind of gray area, and I think from our position, it's about trying to have that kind of clear cut. This is for work purposes, and this is devices, and trying to have that kind of segmentation.
Yeah, that's what I try and do with the bulk of my clients when. Because this question comes up quite a lot, in all honesty, and I remember going on a course a few years ago where a lady had mentioned that at her workplace there'd been a star put in by one of her colleagues because she was felt like she was being bullied by her team, and WhatsApp messages were part of this. So even though it was WhatsApp messages on personal devices relating to non-work chats, because at some point in that conversation, they've been talking about work-related topics and had identified people by various different identifiers. The ICO ruled that they needed to provide those WhatsApp conversations, which I thought was quite scary, because I think everyone probably has conversations they shouldn't have.
Yeah. I remember reading up on the ICO's website once, and it was saying that if, you know, there's a reasonable assumption that, I guess, work-related matters or personal data in you know, the context of that business or organisation were likely to be on, you know, say, a WhatsApp group chat or messaging chat, then it can fall within a SAR. But it, you know, obviously it just seems really intrusive, and you can offer training around it and making sure that individuals don't do that. But like you say, at the end of the day, it's probably going to happen. So then do you separate it between, okay, it's on a work device, yes, we will access it, or no, it's a personal device, but it's used for work matters, okay, we can access that. How does that, do you know what I mean?
It's almost like you need to get someone to sign some form of document that says you can access my personal phone, I give you permission, blah, 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 at the start of a contract or something. But again, I wouldn't be happy to do that. So I don't see why anyone else would be.
Yeah.
Shane's
asking me to chat.
Beat me to it. Yeah.
I'll ask you the question. What, in your opinion, are the corporate risks to an organisation in relation to Meta, Facebook, Threads, not being compliant with the fair and lawful processing principle?
That's really interesting. I think really it's from a to kind of answer your question with another question, it's going to come down to what information do you, from a corporate perspective, do you put on Facebook, and what do you use, like, regarding, like, from a corporate perspective, using it for groups, do you have a public Facebook account as an organization? I believe Threads is the new Twitter,
like Twitter, isn't it?
Yeah, like Facebook's version of Twitter or whatever. I think it really will bottle down to what information are you putting onto these platforms, and then from that, let's say you put on, I don't know, you have an account, basic kind of personal identifiable information on there that falls in scope of GDPR, it's going to kind of come down to that relationship you have. Now, I'm assuming your relationship would then be like kind of a controller to processor. You would hold some liability, I would assume, as a controller in that relationship. I mean, ladies, please disagree with me if you do, but that's just the way that I kind of, like, I'm making a lot of assumptions here, of course, but that's the way that I would read it into it.
It's worth risk assessing on a case by case basis as well, to see what the, you know, like you say, what the relationship is, what you can do to control, you know, your responsibilities within that, and then whether you can mitigate any risks that are highlighted.
Exactly.
I hope that answers your question.
But kind of another point, actually, I just want to kind of jump onto it as well, is let's just say the ICO does rule, like, right, that's it. Facebook as a processor is absolutely terrible. Everyone who uses Facebook, you know, you could be held some kind of liability. How would the ICO manage that? Because that could be an incredibly long list, you know, because who doesn't use Facebook nowadays? I mean, if I log on to my work device and onto my Facebook, does that mean, you know, effectively DPP, are they a process, controlling that relationship? So I think, kind of going back to what Jasmine just said, really identifying the risks and putting really effective controls in place to mitigate said risks. A way you could possibly manage that is a suggestion that I've in previous employment that people don't like is you could kind of block Facebook on work devices and such, and have really effective kind of policies and controls in place. If not that, then you want to really put in a really effective kind of training and making people aware of what information that could be going out onto kind of social media. Hopefully that answers a bit more of like a risk analysis and more of a corporate risk perspective.
That just reminded me of that as well. It's still on brand, but slightly off topic. You really should err on the side of caution in terms of what information you're putting on social media, you know, even in responding to comments and so on. I remember a case once, it was a personal data breach, and I think a customer of an organization had complained about something. I can't remember exactly what it was in relation to, but someone from the organization responded and saying, we're really sorry for this, we're speaking with you, the power of attorney, about blah de blah. And that individual complained, saying that you've just disclosed to everybody that I've got a power of attorney, that you've disclosed that information relating to, I guess, my health and so on. And It did turn out to be a personal data breach, because it wasn't necessary to disclose that, it was available to everyone. It should have been confidential. So it can be, something with the best intentions, but you really just need to control minimize how much or what you're saying on platforms.
To kind of jump on that even further, because we're going to hopefully tie this into a news piece that has come out. But when you're doing, when you are processing personal data, I think it's really important as from a corporate perspective is to know if a subject access request is made, what information are you going to make available to that data subject? For people who don't know, it's been in the news a bit with Nigel Farage and having his bank account closed. He put in a SAR, and I believe they said that it was for financial reasons.
It didn't meet the financial eligibility criteria.
That's it. But then what they had noted down was something different, that was discovered through a SAR. And I believe Nigel Farage has now made that very, very public. And I think, again, from a corporate risk perspective, it's just stuff that you need to take into account when processing personal data. When you're doing your DPIAs, we do get them through support, and we'll see the kind of risk management side. And we're always kind of asking, well, there must be more risks. What other risks? Have you thought about, the rights to the individual? Because they are effectively a risk, and then it's really about how do we manage it, what controls do you have in place to respond to that request within the 30 working days, what training do the staff know, are they aware of what they're saying, can be kind of flagged up and whatnot. So again, really kind of spin it back into a corporate perspective, these are the things that you really need to take into account when you are kind of identifying risks, not just from a GDPR perspective, but like from a corporate perspective, from a company perspective.
It surprised me, that case. A lot of the time you'll see, SAR made, and it'll be with the intention of finding something, that's really going to people either use it as, they can use it as a weapon, or they can use it to find something that usually doesn't exist. And it surprised me in this case it actually definitely did. I saw a little snapshot of something that was disclosed as part of that SAR from the bank, saying that Nigel Farage is seen as xenophobic and racist. He is considered by many to be a disingenuous grifter. Being associated with NF presents a material and ongoing reputational risk to the bank. I just found that quite juicy.
And
it just baffles me, the fact that that was released to him as a SAR, as part of the SAR.
And to kind of jump on that, I believe last week, or was it 2 weeks ago? I can't remember the politician. She put a SAR to the House of Lords, and I remember discussing with Phil. I cannot remember who it was. It was the politician who said that she's going to resign immediately, but hasn't. I can't remember who she's called. But yeah, she has put in a SAR as well. And you know, going back to what we said at the very beginning, you know, the SAR Bureau is really kind of picking up. We are seeing more and more SARs kind of coming in. It just seems, yes, thank you, Nadine Doris. That is it. Thank you, Anne. we are seeing more and more SARs kind of be used, and it's interesting to see more and more people becoming very aware of their data protection rights. And whatnot.
Absolutely. Petra's put in the chat about, I've not seen this in the news to be honest, but Outlook have been hacked by China and taken US and EU government official data. So if you want to unmute and just talk a little bit about that, that'd be appreciated, but no pressure. If not, I'll just move on. So I've also...
Yes, there she is.
Yeah, they were just really saying that they found a vulnerability within Outlook and they exploited that and obviously targeted especially US government officials and were able to hack into their accounts and steal data.
Right. So when was this discovered?
2 weeks ago or so.
No, thank you for that. I'll do some digging. I've also seen in the news that Apple may or has suggested to withdraw in iMessage and FaceTime over changes to the UK law. So I can't remember the name of the legislation. I've got it somewhere in my notes, but
no, it's not the first time that threats like this have been made, though, has it? I mean, Signal said the exact same thing, as did WhatsApp.
And Meta as Meta as WhatsApp.
Well, Meta as a whole, but
yeah. So it relates to I don't know. I think the bill's just been passed about. Hold on, let me try and find it.
No worries, it's going
to annoy me otherwise. But basically, it relates to encryption. So the online safety bill, that's it. So amendments have been passed relating to Ofcom. So they will be able to access any what should be encrypted messages relating to child safety online. So that goes against, it's got good intentions, but I guess there's privacy concerns as well, because, it goes against end-to-end encryption that is offered by Apple and Meta and these.
What do you guys think of that then?
Mixed feelings, really.
it is a very interesting point. I mean, like from one perspective, it weakens everyone else's kind of posture in terms of data privacy. However, it is in the nature to protect, you know, young children. I think it's a quite an interesting, I do to some extent think it's quite an extreme approach though, because there are possibly other ways to kind of protect children in that sense. But again, it depends on how deep you kind of go into it, because on one hand you can try and prevent children from actually having access to these kind of telephone devices and making sure that kind of like locked out. But on the flip side, you know, that would be nearly impossible to govern.
Exactly. That's what I was just thinking. How exactly would they govern that and be able to say, well, yes, this is definitely, we're definitely this for children right here. Because let's face it, you sign up to an account for WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, and all you have to do is tick a box that says I'm over 13. There's no way that you physically have to prove your age, is there? So how are they physically able to say, well, yes, this definitely relates to a child, or this definitely relates to an adult?
Yeah, it is definitely a massive challenge. I mean, this is a little bit stepping away from GDPR, but it was a very interesting case that happened, I believe, like 3 years ago with YouTube. So if you sign up to YouTube and have an account with YouTube, you have to be over, I think it's 16 or 18. I can't remember the exact nitty gritty details. But on the flip side, YouTube was saying how great it was because it had that like one of the largest under like 16 demographics, at which point it's called COPPA, which is the federal US regulations. They fined YouTube, Google, a lot of money. We're talking into the billions for effectively admitting to processing child data and not having the right safeguards in. And I've noticed there is starting to be more and more of a trend. And what we're finding is for the kind of greater good, we are removing kind of privacy and controls to everyone in order to try and protect kind of children. You know, if let's say iMessenger goes and FaceTime, does that mean we'll lose WhatsApp? You know, are they going to follow suit? Is Facebook going to start to decide not to do it, you know, because it's not protecting everyone?
Yeah, and you know, this might be a bit of a reach, but in some ways I feel like it contradicts the intention behind the data reform bill, you know, to free up like movement of data and for financial reasons really, and benefits. And I feel like this is a backwards approach that contradicts that. So I think as well it's funny because it's almost like we're swapping places with the US in some instances.
Doesn't it?
It's like they're you know, they might be amending FISA by the end of the year and their access to I guess pretty much any information, whereas we're taking the opposite approach. So I wonder what effect that might have on UK adequacy.
I was just thinking that, my heart was racing, thinking, oh no.
Yeah.
You see it going through your head.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see how that one progresses as well. There's just a lot going on at the minute and I don't know, it doesn't seem to be a streamlined route either. But I've also seen as well that OpenAI withholds ChatGPT image analysis features on over privacy concerns. So ChatGPT 4, a bit of a sentence there, has a function where, well, or intends to have a function where you can upload images for it to process. So there's still a lot of questions, ethical and legal questions around that. So we've suspended it for the time being. So it's intended to be multimodal, meaning it can process images as well as text, which, as I say, allows users to upload photos to unlock brand new applications such as identifying issues with a broken car engine. It could also help visually impaired users recognise objects. So with the next generation of AI being able to vocalise a description of an image, this includes...
That would be beneficial. I can see that being beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, that just comes down to the core of AI. It can be used for good, or it can, you know, be misused at the same time. My cousin, actually, I've got a cousin in South Africa. He works in tech and like he has like a technology college, but also it's quite innovative as well. So he creates AI robots and stuff. It's a bit mad. He's developing or working on developing glasses that do the same thing. So to help blind people where, you know, it can read text in front of you. I'm not sure how that would, you know, the logistics of that would work because, you know, is it basic? I don't know, like signs on a bottle or is it like a whole book or menu or what? I'm not sure. Mm. I might ask him actually to see how that would work.
See if he wants to join the podcast.
Yeah. We'll ask him about South African data search. I'm not sure how much he knows about that. But
I mean, with all this talk about AI, once again, the EU have urged the US to join the fight to regulate AI. I think it was about a month ago now, maybe two, we had the owners of ChatGPT or the company that kind of owns it. They kind of went to Congress and had a big speech and talking about, you know, that they do want some kind of regulation. The EU said that they want to regulate this quite a lot, and America wasn't exactly over keen with that. And once again, you know, the EU are trying to urge the US to make sure this is regulated well. And they've had, you know, They've had, you know, some big people kind of back them, as well as like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, the owner of Meta and whatnot, to really kind of like try and contribute and ensure that it is regulated well. It is great that we are getting AI to be able to be utilized in a way that's going to be very beneficial, like diagnosis and whatnot. Really, you know, the potential is limitless. Could really like speed up a lot of the processes. However, with that being said, there are genuine great dangers with AI, especially around children and understanding, you know, understanding that. And I think it's really important. It's going to be really key to make sure that everybody does regulate this quite well. How GDPR will interact with that, I'm not sure, because I believe AI, you know, it can go beyond the realm of personal data. So it'll be really interesting to see that relationship if a regulation does come out of AI, or come out for AI, should I say.
I mean, it's just such a powerful tool, isn't it? So the sooner the better. But I don't know if we've not got harmony across different legislative territories, then it'll just hinder the process even more, won't it?
Yeah, it'll fall like how data protection's kind of gone. You know, we've got GDPR and it's kind of creeping jurisdiction, and heavily influencing lots of other jurisdictions to kind of get that adequacy decision. At what point do we just need to get an international agreement in place, you know? But again, steering a little bit away from GDPR, it's a similar issue with what's it called, copyright. You know, there is some international agreements in place, but no real uniformed approach, and we see in that sector there's a lot of complications. And I believe GDPR, with it being kind of intangible assets, not physical things, it's going to follow possibly the same problem. And I also believe that a lot of data protection is also heavily influenced by culture, you know, whatnot. I think the last time I was on this podcast, I think it was about 2-3 weeks ago, someone did, which I agree, talk about how the US is more, everything's open, everything's personal unless you say it's personal, whereas the UK, it's more, everything's, private, and you choose what is going to be made public. So it's a very much a culture war of kind of fighting against each other.
Absolutely.
I just went off around to tangent right there.
It's always about having Dave Holmes back.
Tony is clarified in the chat as well. So optical readers would read like any OCR or text, like the Orcam scanner and Seeing AI from Microsoft as well. So thank you for that. I feel like, you know, in a similar gist of AI as well, it's just, you can see how technology is, it's just excelling and it's just become so much more of a way of life, like
massively.
I think it
was in the news this week that Eurostar have decided to introduce facial recognition in St Pancras. So essentially what they've said is that any passengers aged 60 and above departing from St Pancras can essentially avoid sort of that whole manual checking of your tickets, manual checking of your passports. And they've launched some kind of smart check app, basically. So you have to register your passport, your ticket, and then a scan of your face, and you can just basically walk straight through. The only check that you'd have to do at St Pancras is like the usual security baggage type checks, but the rest of it is just straightforward walk through. And then you'd probably, well, you would have a passport checked at the other end, I suppose, but it's kind of taken away that personal person-to-person interaction as well, which, you know, I quite like that. If I can avoid speaking to people, I will.
So he's going to say if I can avoid paying.
Well, it's like the whole, you know, ordering drinks and food to your table. I like doing that because it means that I have to go speak to someone at the bar. It's great. If I can avoid it, I will.
Yeah. And then you can put your table and location on Instagram or something and get people to buy you drinks.
Send me a drink. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and on the topic of my cousin again, so I went to visit him in South Africa a few weeks ago, and he lives in a gated community, just, you know, for security reasons and so on. It's a nice area, but, you know, it's just one of those places where it's required. And to get in and out of his complex, you need facial recognition. I found it as a novelty, but obviously it only works with people who are registered on the system and so on. So it's just popping up, you know, more and more.
They're using it a lot, boarding planes quicker the other end as well. So instead of having someone scan your ticket, they'll just do a facial scan, and if it recognises it, it lets you through. If not, you have to speak to a person. But
yeah, I wouldn't mind that, to be honest. You know, the airport.
I find gyms are starting to use like fingerprints. I mean, the gym that I go to, they operate have a 24/7 service, and the way it works is you scan your fingerprint, and then I politely remind him, where's your privacy notice, and he runs away and doesn't tell me. I'm like, oh, okay, well, we need to help him with that, I think. But I find like a lot of businesses are starting to use, you know, maybe not facial scan recognition, but the fingerprints and biometric information. Which is, again, I think quite interesting, but, you know, are they aware of their, you know, responsibilities as a controller? Is it their privacy notice as a roper? Have they done an impact assessment? You know, there's 101 things, and I am that boring of a person. I will speak to people outside of work about this kind of stuff. And it's just not on people's radar.
No, I know. And that's the thing as well. It's excelling probably quicker than... you know, individual organizations' compliance with the GDPR, even, I know, but like 5 years on, but the amount of organizations, even customers, you know, that aren't aware of the extent of what they need to be doing to comply with data protection law, it's worrying, really, because you know it happens. So I guess it's what can be done around raising awareness of that, really. Getting together a lot of compliance projects for all of these organisations, I saw something interesting a week or two ago, actually, in the news. So an IT worker hijacked a blackmail hack. He tried to get £300,000 worth, a £300,000 ransom paid to himself. So he's hacking the hacking process, essentially.
Intercepting the hack, yeah.
Yeah, so he works for Oxford Biomedica, and they experienced the hack. I think from their old, I might be wrong in saying it was their old chief exec, but definitely somebody who used to work there, and tried to, I guess, defer the ransomware money to his own account, got caught, and is doing 4 years in prison now, basically. So I couldn't find, I don't have enough time to look, to be fair, but where it was, whether it was under Computer Misuse Act or what, but yeah, a little juicy snippet.
Yeah. It's nice to see there's, you know, some teeth behind it as well. We're actually seeing the regulators take decent action.
Absolutely. And also, so the European Data Protection Board has adopted guidance on control of binding corporate rules as well. So the purpose for this, it's to provide a standard form for the application for approval of BCRs for controllers, clarify the necessary content as stated in Article 47 on binding corporate rules, and clarify what must be presented to the lead supervisory authority in the application as well.
That's really interesting. I didn't personally see that. But I always find BCR being kind of one of the weirder safeguard mechanisms for international transfers. You know, you typically see adequacy decision and then standard contractual clauses, and then you've kind of got binding corporate rules. So it's nice to see a bit more kind of guidance around that. It's always been one that's, I think, been the more difficult out of the three to kind of achieve.
Yeah, I mean, with binding corporate rules, I've had this debate previously, and I was under the impression that binding corporate rules, if an organisation, I'm pretty sure, for example, DocuSign have binding corporate rules, because they're international and operate, you know, in various countries, so they all commit to a GDPR level of compliance. I thought then that meant that any organisation that works with DocuSign can be satisfied that, you know, there's a safeguarding mechanism in place, whereas I've been challenged on that, and apparently it's more the fact that means that DocuSign can transfer information you know, internally or, you know, between the intergroup or whatnot freely, which to me, obviously, you know, it's good for that organisation, but it doesn't seem to be, I don't think it's clear that it's not a safeguard mechanism available to all other organisations as part of that transfer.
Well, we had a workshop, didn't we, about this, not specifically that example, but about
last week, you know, wasn't it?
Yeah, talking about like international transfers and whatnot, and we looked at the guidance from the ICO, and yeah, there was a lot of lacking of guidance. whereas we found some points that kind of contradicted it, where, you know, if you're doing a particular kind of transfer, then you don't need to have like an impact assessment if you've got other controls in place. But then we found that you kind of needed to. So it was a very it is a very kind of gray area, especially around, you know, BCR. So it is, you know, welcoming to see that, you know, that the European Data Protection Board has adopted more guidance. Whether the ICO will follow suit and update, we will have to wait and see.
Absolutely,
very true.
We've got about six minutes left, so I guess, what cases, you know, have you had any interesting cases?
What's the question for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a question for me.
It's the support desk manager.
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring up basically a really interesting case that that we had. And it's about the scope of GDPR and when is something applicable, when something not. We had a client kind of come up to us with a very particular situation. And one of their, I believe it was a tenant, they were going down a complaints procedure and they wanted to kind of resolve it.
One.
Yes, because I came to you to ask for your opinion. And we were discussing, basically, the tenant wanted to record that information. And the question really was, you know, can we say anything to stop them recording it? Or, you know, what are the ramifications? Are they subject to GDPR? And it kind of gets you thinking, well, when does an individual, so, you know, like me on my own, when do I fall into scope of GDPR? And we looked into this and it turns out, you know, as long as it's for domestic or personal use, great. But then you start to then realize actually that scope starts to creep out when you start to upload stuff to social media, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. You know, I mean, I already kind of know what Charlotte's opinions on this are, but what are your thoughts on this?
I think I've dealt with similar cases to this from working, you know, in social housing for the past however many years. And there have been times where I had to clearly state to people, look, we can provide you with, you can record these calls or we can share these call recordings with you for personal use, but they will be for personal use. And that will obviously also include if you want to seek some form of legal counsel or whatever that may look like. But from working in social housing, I do know that quite often there is an ulterior motive and quite often it is to put things on social media to make the organisation look bad and try and bounce towards that reputational damage piece. So it's really difficult. You can say you can record this, but, you know, it could be for your personal use, for family use or, you know, legal counsel. But how can you then say, how can you then determine that that's exactly what they're going to do? You know, you can withdraw your consent from having that call recorded, but also on the flip side, most housing organisations will also record any incoming phone calls anyway. So, it, you know, there's a chance that that housing provider has already got that call recorded. So how do you get around it?
It's a good point you kind of suggested that, because the way that we kind of summarised it is, you know, you can kind of do one or two things, either no, saying, you know, no, you can't record, or yes, or if they are, you can, you know, put in kind of like remind them of their GDPR responsibilities. But an interesting way that was similar to what you just said and one of my team suggested was to kind of keep the control in-house, say to the data subject, okay, yes, you know, but instead of, you know, if you want to record it, you can, but we're going to record this conversation as well. And then we will give you a copy so that everyone has a copy of this and really try and take kind of control if you're okay with, you know, whoever's involved to have that information being recorded. I thought it was a really interesting way to kind of to handle it, to try and kind of put yourself in a very good kind of posture and position around that kind of like understanding where that data is and what that copy of that data is as well. I do think one of the challenges, though, is that, let's say, I don't know, Charlotte, you decide to record it and you decide to upload it to YouTube. How do we challenge that from a GDPR perspective? You know, we go to the ICO, really to the ICO, do they need an email address, or, you know, how do they actually contact the individual for doing that? So it is quite kind of tricky. And I personally haven't seen a case presented to the ICO where they've made public where someone has used data, said that you can use it for personal reasons and used it beyond the scope, or should I say, put it within scope of GDPR.
I think I'm not sure if this would 100% answer the question, but, you know, having an organizational policy to say, you know, either approach and say, you know, you can record this, but be aware that if you, you know, misuse this information or take it past, you know, personal reasons, then you will become an independent controller of that information and you will be liable to this. We might take this approach, and, you know, you've got it down in policy, and maybe have them agree to that, or just take the other approach and say, we do not allow this, we do not permit this. If we're aware that you're doing it, you know, our staff can suspend the call or the interaction.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'd usually probably, you know, sway more to the latter, to protect, you know, staff as well. Obviously, you want to do the best for your customers, but you've got a duty to protect your staff and make sure that their information is not being misused as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
And with that being said, that's time.
Okay. That went quite quick, to be fair.
It did.
We got to talk about a lot.
Yeah. So thank you everyone very much for joining, and thank you so much Charlotte and Tristan for your support on this. It wouldn't have been as interesting me on my own, so it's been a great session. I'm sure we will have you back.
Oh, most likely.
Yeah.
And have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you next week, hopefully.
Thank you everyone.
Speak to you later.
Next week's is on data retention as well. Thank you. All right. See you later.
Bye, everyone. Bye. Thank you.